Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, March 10th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. Today's mini editorial is written by William Burroughs of Sioux City, and William writes, "There was talk of closing the Perry Creek Branch Library at the city's budget meeting last Wednesday. Banning books is one thing, but closing a library is a whole different thing. No way." Again, this was written by William Burroughs of Sioux City. Our first front page story is written by Nick Heitruck of the Sioux City Journal, and the headline is "Weather Cycles May Be Stressing Plants." Sure, wearing shorts in February and March feels wonderful. It sure beats shivering while walking through snowdrifts. We'd all love to put away our winter coats for the season. But here's a little dose of reality for everyone who's enjoyed time outside during the past few unseasonably warm weeks. It needs to be colder. Look in your backyard or garden. Tulips have emerged and are already several inches tall. You will find swelling buds on some trees. Nature is about 2 to 4 weeks ahead of schedule. So when that inevitable cold snap happens, it's only early March after all, it could mean trouble for fruit trees, shrubs, and perennials that think it's time to wake up and start budding, blooming, and growing. Carol Larvick, University of Nebraska Extension educator and a master gardener, said, "The trees and bushes and perennials, all of them have gotten too early of a head start." A walk in her backyard in South Sioux City shows the effects of a February that was the second warmest on record. In Sioux City, daily high temperatures in February averaged 49.4 degrees, well above the normal of 34. February 26 saw a high of 77 degrees, a record for any day in February. 5 days saw a high of at least 60 degrees and 8 more of at least 50. It's only gotten warmer in March. We've already had 1 day above 70 degrees. And through Thursday, the lowest high temperature on any day was 51 degrees. The average high of 58.9 degrees was 17 degrees above normal. No wonder trees and other plants think it's time to wake up. Larvick said, "I have noticed several where the buds are a lot more swollen than they normally would be. The really big thing we're worried about is having a strong freeze later on. Tulips, daffodils, and crocuses are hardy enough to weather a blast of cold air," she said. "But if fruit trees begin to blossom, a hard freeze could kill those blossoms and it could mean no fruit this year. It only takes one night or two of temperatures well below freezing to put a chill on the early growing season. And days bouncing from warm to cold don't help either. The extreme stress trees and shrubs have come out of dormancy and are budding are trying to shoot leaves. If they do freeze, it's unlikely to cause permanent damage, but trees cannot go back into dormancy and will just restart the spring process, using up more energy and leafing out later than usual," said Jordan Smith, a Papio, Missouri River Natural Resource District forester in Nebraska. Smith said, "When it goes from the 70s to 20 to 30 to 60 to 30, they can't figure out what's going on. Most trees should be fine. It's not great, but we can't control the weather." A majority of days this winter had above normal high temperatures, pushing the spring grain up ahead 2 to 4 weeks, said Justin Gleason, Iowa State climatologist. Gleason said, "Overall, we are just getting started with spring earlier. We need to go back to normal. We need to go back to a cooler temperature range." That's looking unlikely. Weather models show an elevated chance for above normal temperatures for March, April, and May. But at least those same models also include chances for increased precipitation, which is also badly needed as the warm, often windy days have begun drying out topsoil. In a region that's been battling drought for the past few years, any odds showing above average precipitation are welcome. Gentry Sorensen, a field agronomist with Iowa State University Extension and Outreach in Algona, whose area extends into Dickinson, Clay, and Buena Vista County, said, "The warm conditions are not an extreme alarm right now as long as our precipitation is normal. If we had more normal temperatures and some precipitation, that would be more ideal." Snow, frost, and freezes can occur into May, so we can safely assume temperatures will dip below freezing again at some point. As hard as it may be, we've got to temper our enthusiasm for spring and keep that winter coat handy. Our next article is written by Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal, and the headline is Announcement Imminent on Completion of New Jail. An announcement regarding the completion date of the Woodbury County Law Enforcement Center is expected to take place next week. The Law Enforcement Center Authority expects to announce a completion date. Shane Albrecht of the Baker Group, project manager for the jail, told the Journal Friday. Currently, the completion date is set for April 9th. Albrecht said they are waiting to make an announcement until Iowa Chief Jail Inspector Delbert Longley inspects the facility starting Monday. After we see where that goes, we're going to provide an updated completion date to everybody. A May 23rd date has been proposed by Hausman Construction, the Lincoln, Nebraska-based general contractor, in documents submitted to the authority starting November 20th, 2023. That completion date isn't anything official yet. They're reserving the right for the completion date to be that, Albrecht told the Journal. The new jail was originally expected to be completed in March 2023 when it was bid in 2021. It was later pushed back to August 2023 and then to September 14, 2023. A day before the September 14th deadline for contractors to finish their work, LEC leaders announced the completion date had been pushed back to a proposed April 9th. A prime contract change order sent by Hausman Construction to the authority states, "Please note that our new substantial completion date is proposed for May 23, 2024, as identified within PCO 114. The document was created on November 20, 2023 and went before the board on January 30th. The May 23rd completion date was also listed on another prime contract change order created on February 6 and reviewed by the board on February 13th. The authority rejected Hausman's proposed change order 114 for additional costs and times, according to a news release dated January 30th, but did not share what the additional cost or time was. Since the September delay, the authority has given regular updates on the project and ongoing work. On February 27th, Shane Albrecht of the Baker Group, a consultant for the project, said the substantial completion date is still set for April 9th. The authority, GGA, and Hausman are continuing to discuss Hausman's previously requested additional time and expense for this damper work, with which the authority and GGA has expressed their disagreement, according to a news release. The authority and its counsel continue to assess its additional costs and damages on the project caused by the actions, inactions, and delays by Hausman, GGA, and GGA's mechanical engineering sub-consultant in Troba, and are taking the proper steps to ultimately hold the responsible parties liable for such additional costs and damages to be incurred by the authority. On February 7th, the authority announced a construction change directive had been issued related to certain work that will need to be performed on the mechanical system. No information was given regarding what specifically needed to be done. The cost and time impact of CCD 10R is still being determined, according to the news release. And then a water leak was found in the new law enforcement center on Tuesday. At approximately 1:40 a.m. Tuesday, Woodbury County Sheriff's deputies found water leaking in the loading dock, Albrecht said Thursday. At around 5:30 p.m. Tuesday, Albrecht said Hausman Construction arrived at the facility and found a water line was leaking. Albrecht said security footage showed water leaking from around 10 p.m. Monday. He added, "Thankfully, a lot of the construction in the jail is concrete walls, floors, with some drains around it," but added there was damage to the facility, including to the fireproofing and ceiling tiles. "No project delay is expected because of the damage," Albrecht said, "and Hausman Construction is working to correct the damage and has contacted their insurance provider." Albrecht and LEC Chair Ron Wick said more information will be determined at a later date regarding what happened and who is responsible. Our next story is headlined Back in Business, about OPA time. It was smiles all around for the owner of a Sioux City restaurant, which will soon reopen more than a year after a devastating fire. There was a flurry of activity Wednesday as crews installed air handling equipment in the newly renovated Opa Time restaurant, 2129 Hamilton Boulevard. "This is getting back my life. I am like a fish out of," said Opa owner Peter Canidas, searching for the word water to complete the well-known phrase. The Sioux City Institution was destroyed by fire on January 29, 2023. Fire officials ruled the cause as spontaneous combustion of oily rags. His son George has been working with his family in the business since he was a little boy. George Canidas said, "We are excited. It has just been a long process. We didn't know if this was even possible when the fire had happened. We thought maybe we'd have to walk. So for this to come all together, even after this week, we are very thankful. But more importantly, we are very excited to get back and serve the Siouxland community the best gyros that we can." Depending on inspections and permitting, the family hopes to open the business sometime around March 18th to the 25th. "Original never change," Peter said when asked if they had made any changes in the menu in anticipation of the reopening. Canidas arrived in the United States in 1990 from his native Greece. Opa Time serves traditional Greek dishes like gyros, souvlaki pitas, and baklava, as well as American burgers, patty melts, chicken fried steak, and fish. He said customers can expect a surprise as the business gets up and running again, but he declined to give any details. Peter is anxious to get back to his customers, adding, "I give good service to the people. It's not about the money." The family has a long punch list to get through before reopening. "I never want to overpromise and underdeliver," George said. "Here in a week or two, we'll be open and right back at it." The remaining work includes installation of the drop ceiling, new equipment underneath the hood in the kitchen, and paint touch-ups. "There are little details. We will go around and look at all the details and make sure everything is ready to go before we open," George said. Our next story is about the East High Robotics team. East High School's Epsilon Robotics has qualified for the World Robotics Championships in April. Last weekend, Epsilon was one of three Iowa teams to qualify for the World Championship, which takes place in Houston in April. In 2020, Epsilon qualified for the World Championship, but it was canceled due to COVID-19. Team Epsilon is made up of Garrett Thompson, Garrett Burnite, Dylan Gibbs, Ben Kleber, and Colin Cavanaugh. In the season, Epsilon had a record of 27-7-0 at their six official events this year, and ranks fourth in the Iowa Norman Rockwell League. Epsilon holds the fifth highest scored match in the United States and the ninth highest scored match in the entire world. On March 1st and March 2nd, 72 teams from Iowa and Nebraska competed in the first Tech Challenge Iowa Championship. Epsilon finished 4-1 and will proceed to the World Championship along with THOR from Johnston, Iowa, and Shell Bots from Waverly, Iowa. With approximately 6,500 teams competing in the world, 192 qualify for the World Championship. East High's Robotics Club was founded in 2013. For the past eight seasons, Trevor Miller has overseen the team. Miller said he has pushed students to commit to the club and treat it like any other athletic activity. While Miller said there is a learning curve, students do not have to be inherently talented in engineering and coding. The teams meet every day after school, starting in September. Each year, competitions focus on a different task. This year, the teams were tasked with picking up small plastic hexagons called pixels and placing them on a board. They also have to hang their robot from a bar with no support other than the motor and shoot a paper airplane called a drone. The robots have the capability of using a camera and machine learning to detect randomized variables within the game field. There are multiple different ways for the teams to score points. Miller said the team first discusses what aspects of the challenge they want to focus on to get the most scoring and in what order to do the tasks. Slowly, they start planning the engineering and coding that goes into the robot. Because of the success of the program in Miller's first 2 years, more students have been interested in joining. This year, they had 3 robotics teams, 2 of which qualified for state. Thompson, a senior at East and a member of Epsilon, joined the robotics team because of his passion for programming and coding. He said the competition last weekend was a collection of the best robotics teams in Nebraska and Iowa to show what high schoolers can do. Epsilon is fundraising for the necessary $11,000 to travel to the World Championships. The 2024 first championship takes place in Houston, April 17th through April 20th. Those interested in assisting the team may contact East High School Robotics Coaches Thompson at 712-212-3168 or Miller at 712-389-0550. Our next article is about the death of a local rock and roller. His name was Don Bourre, or I'm not sure how you pronounce it. It's spelled B-O-U-R-R-E-T. Bourette. Don Bourette, the longtime drummer for one of Sioux City's first rock and roll groups, the Valairs, who scored a hit on the Billboard charts with a cover of Roll Over Beethoven, died this week at the age of 83. Bourette was born May 11, 1940 in Sioux City, the son of Charles and Maisel Bourette. He graduated from Central High School and married Donna Taylor Lee on June 2, 1974 in Sioux City. He was first married to Rita Bartakowski, who died in 2012. Survivors include his current wife, Donna, children Sean, Darwin, Russell, and Robin of Sioux City, 4 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren with 1 on the way. Bourette, who logged many years as a paint salesman, got going with the whole rock thing in the late 1950s at Central High School with a group then known as the Screamers. Truth be known, we actually got our start as a group of mostly swimmers who like to sing in the shower. So we decided to enter the Central High School talent show. The singers were Denny Wurster, Jerry DeMars, and Jeff Lockhart, and musicians Bob Dowdy, Roger Hughes, and myself. Our sextet performed Be Bapa Lula, Bourette told the Journal in 2013. When playing the rockabilly tune by Gene Vincent and his Blue Caps, Bourette said the singers would scream. In late 1958, Bourette said Dan Matusek joined the band, which recalibrated to become the Flares and eventually the first iteration of the Valairs. The name change came after a show at Des Moines Val Air Ballroom and was driven by the need to get out of a contractual obligation. 1958 was quite a year for rock music, which was still only a few years old. Over the course of 1958, Eddie Cochran dropped the song Summertime Blues, Buddy Holly and the Crickets released Rave On, and Chuck Berry came out with Sweet Little 16, just to name a few. When the Valairs finally broke big themselves, it was with a cover of another Chuck Berry track, Roll Over Beethoven. Their take, released on the JB label in 1961, became a Billboard charting hit. It was popular enough to get the group onto Dick Clark's American Bandstand in August, the first Iowa band to do so. Bourette said, "My hands were bandaged because I had just injured them in a water skiing accident at McCook Lake a few days before. It didn't matter since all of the acts appearing on the show were merely lip-synced to their records, and I only had to pretend I was drumming." Bourette's son Darwin hasn't ever seen the show. He was born in 1965, and tapes from that time are hard to come by, but said he's tremendously proud of his dad for reaching that level with his craft, proud enough to follow in Don's footsteps. Darwin said, "Music was everything to him, and he transferred that to me. There are just so many memories I have with him and his music." Dan Matusek's brother Dick told the Journal in 2008, the band's financial status changed significantly after the single and the TV appearance. Matusek said, "The Valairs were making $150 to $200 a gig before Roll Over Beethoven. After that, they were making double or triple that in their live shows." Dowdy remembered sharing the stage with such high-profile performers as Ricky Nelson while performing at the Michigan State Fair. "We were on stage with our idols," he said in 2008, "but the audience wanted to see us." The band released 8 more singles on various record labels, including covers of Dream by Johnny Mercer and Ubangi Stomp by Earl Bostic. The original members stayed together until 1963. Matusik reformed the band soon after under the name Danny and the Valairs, which stayed together until 1970. In 1997, the original members of the Valairs were inducted into the Iowa Rock and Roll Music Association Hall of Fame. The same year, the Valairs had a greatest hits record put out on the Bear Family Records label. Matusik died the following year. Dottie died at his home in Sioux City in 2013. But the Valairs continued touring with Barrett, who had a bout with throat cancer in the 2000s, and keyboardist Gene Ambrosen, bassist Mike King, and guitarist Bill Chopper Pelchett, and saxophonist Dave Napier. The group played its final show at the Skyline Bar and Casino in North Sioux City on July 3, 2019. Rock and roll was great when I was younger, and it's just as much fun today, Barrett said in 2014. I love my life, and I would not change a thing. A public visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday at the Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel in Sioux City. Police arrest second person in Sioux City stabbing. A second person believed to be involved in an assault that included a stabbing in downtown Sioux City has been arrested. Pasamino Noah, 28, of Sioux City, was arrested Thursday on a charge of assault with intent to inflict serious injury, an aggravated misdemeanor. His bond was set at $5,000. He's accused of following and striking a man in the 500 block of 5th Street at approximately 9:30 p.m. February 5th. According to court documents, security footage showed Noah punching the man and knocking him to the ground. The man then was stabbed multiple times by Darfus Stewart. While the victim was still on the ground, Noah kicked him in the head. The victim sustained a head injury and a stab wound in the lower right arm that caused a large amount of blood loss. Stewart, 23, of Sioux City, was arrested March 1st on a charge of willful injury, a Class D felony. We now have some articles about actions being taken by the state legislature. And the first one is House blocks undocumented immigrants from public aid. Iowa House Republicans passed legislation Thursday intended to crack down on the smuggling of undocumented immigrants into the state and prevent them from accessing public assistance programs. House File 2608 passed 60-32 with all Democrats opposed. The bill expands the verification process for public assistance benefits by the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services to check the citizenship status of those applying under a push by Republicans to block undocumented immigrants from accessing taxpayer benefits. It also creates a new state crime of human smuggling. The bill would make it a felony to encourage or induce a person to enter or remain in the country in violation of federal law by concealing, harboring, or shielding that person from detection. Catholic charities and religious orders that house and assist asylum seekers have expressed concerns they could be targeted should the bill be signed into law. The bill was amended to specify a person commits the offense of smuggling of persons if done knowingly, for payment, or some other benefit. Representative Steve Holt, Republican from Denison, the lead Republican on the bill, said the law is aimed at people engaged in human smuggling, not churches or other organizations, and that the amendment added to the bill alleviates those concerns. He said, "I think we have prosecutorial discretion. I think we have law enforcement discretion, and I think the language is plenty tight." He also noted the state already checks the citizenship status of those applying for public assistance benefits as a result of existing federal law. Holt, however, argued it was important to codify the practice in state law should that change. Democrats said the bill was unnecessary and that concerns about immigration and border security need to be addressed at the federal level. Representative Lindsey James, Democrat from Dubuque, said, "I think we can all agree that the immigration system needs some work. There has been bipartisan legislation worked out across the line on the federal level that imploded because of the politics of Donald Trump and the Republican do-nothing Congress. We should not even be having this discussion today." House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst, Democrat from Windsor Heights, speaking to reporters before the House vote, echoed James. She said, "So the bills like that that are out there are simply playing into a national narrative, national politics, and trying to rile up a base. That's not how we're supposed to write policy. We are supposed to write policy in a way that addresses what Iowans need. This bill does not do that. Rather, she said, Republicans should be focused on improving and expanding access to mental health services and child care and better funding for public schools. Republicans argued the ongoing crisis at the United States-Mexico border has reached critical levels with significant increases in fentanyl and other drug seizures and human trafficking they attributed to a surge in illegal border crossings. Holt and Representative Mark Thompson, Republican from Clarion, emphasized the urgent need for legislation to protect both Iowa residents and immigrants exploited by human smugglers and trafficked for sex or forced labor. Thompson said, human smuggling is a business. It is a disgusting business, but it is a business. So it has supply and it has demand. The supply comes from mostly south of our border. But some of that demand is right here, he said, of immigrants who come to work on farms, meat packers, and elsewhere. Thompson added, we're not doing anyone coming across our border any fair shake, any favors by letting them come across and just come up to Iowa. Asserting their immigration status is used against them as blackmail to deny them a decent wage or should they complain about work conditions. Creating a state crime for human smuggling will allow law enforcement to take action in the absence of sufficient enforcement of federal immigration laws at the U.S.-Mexico border, Holt said. He said, it's a clear and present danger to our nation and our state. The very real, profoundly serious crisis on our southern border demands that we stand up as a state and protect our citizens and ourselves and perhaps discourage human trafficking, labor trafficking, sex trafficking, and all of the garbage that is happening on our southern border and transferring into our state. And the next one is about fertility treatments. The bill would change law from human pregnancy to unborn person. The potential legal impact of a legislative proposal to increase penalties for the non-consensual termination of a pregnancy was a source of debate among state lawmakers Thursday at the Iowa Capitol. Republicans who proposed the bill said it merely heightens penalties for individuals whose actions cause a pregnancy to be terminated. Currently, non-consensual termination of a pregnancy is a felony, punished at different levels depending upon the circumstances under which the pregnancy was terminated. The bill increases those penalties to higher felony levels. Representative Skylar Wheeler, Republican from Hall, said during the debate, "This bill is very simple. It increases penalties for crimes that are ridiculous, killing a mother or her unborn baby." However, the bill also replaces in state law the terms human pregnancy with unborn person and defines an unborn person as from fertilization to live birth. That is the provision that led Democrats to argue the bill could be legally applied to make in vitro fertilization illegal. In vitro fertilization, or IVF, is a fertility treatment by which a woman's egg is combined with a man's sperm in a medical lab and then planting those embryos in the woman's uterus. The Mayo Clinic said it is the most effective fertility treatment. Democrats argued the proposed legislation would make IVF illegal because as part of the process, extra embryos are sometimes frozen, stored, or discarded. They argued the bill does not sufficiently exempt fertility treatments. Representative Heather Mattson, a Democrat from Ankeny, said during the debate, as written, this bill does not explicitly protect IVF and sets a precedent with new language of unborn person. For years, many of us have made the case that legislation or judicial rulings for fetal personhood would potentially make IVF illegal. Democrats referred to a recent decision by the Alabama Supreme Court, which ruled that frozen embryos are children, regardless of whether they are in or out of a uterus. Clinics in Alabama paused some of their services in the wake of the ruling. The state's Republican governor signed a hastily passed bill Wednesday aimed at protecting IVF patients and providers there from legal liability. Mazie Stilwell, public affairs director for the political arm of the women's reproductive health care and abortion services provider Planned Parenthood, issued a statement criticizing the bill as reckless and Republicans for advancing it instead of tackling other health care issues. Stilwell's statement said, "Republicans who control our state government want to continue their far-reaching, long-term strategy to undermine the rights and well-being of pregnant Iowans. We will fight every step of the way to ensure Iowans have access to the essential health care they so desperately need." The bill, House File 2575, passed out of the Iowa House on a 58-36 vote, with only Republicans supporting and three Republicans joining all the Democrats in opposition. The Republican no votes came from Representatives Mark Cisneros of Muscatine, Zach Deacon of Granville, and Brian Losey of Bondurant. With its passage out of the House, the bill is now eligible for consideration in the Iowa Senate. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, March 10th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now go to the obituaries, and there is only one death notice in the paper today. Roger Timko, 74, of Storm Lake, died March 6th. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. on March 14th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Storm Lake. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. March 13th at Fratsky and Jensen Funeral Home in Storm Lake. And arrangements are under the direction of Fratsky and Jensen Funeral Home. And that is all that's in the paper for obituaries today. We'll now move to the opinion page, and we'll begin with an opinion piece from the Journal Editorial Board. "We get head scratchers every week, but this time of the year must bring more than most. For example, the troubled law enforcement center developed a leak this week, but the building hasn't even opened. Damage was reported to the fireproofing and the ceiling tiles. An inspector is scheduled to do a final walkthrough next week. The LEC board plans to announce a new completion date on Tuesday. Here's hoping it won't go beyond the most recent April 9th estimate. But we don't have high expectations that won't happen for a project beset by multiple delays and rising costs. A new building with a leak. The next point. While local school districts are negotiating salary and benefits packages with teachers, the Iowa legislature proposed a $3 million grant program to pay for guns and training for school staff. Somehow, there's a disconnect. The $3 million was originally earmarked for radio equipment that would communicate with a statewide emergency response system. What if teachers don't get the raises they're anticipating, but they're handed a gun and expected to defend their classrooms? Wouldn't it make more sense to spend the money to alert real law enforcement?" Or their next point. "Woodbury County Sheriff Chad Sheehan asked supervisors to fund a $385,000 armored vehicle. He said the department had been asking for one for years. Armored vehicles from other areas were brought in during a standoff at a farm near Hornick last fall that left one man dead from a gunshot. That revived the sheriff's request for the armored vehicle. The Board of Supervisors approved the proposal, but has yet to decide how to cover the remaining $69,000. Maybe we should pay off that $69,000 with the savings the county would realize from its new modern jail. Oh, wait." Then the next item. In the category of how loyal do you have to be, Nebraska Governor Jim Pelham's choice to lead the State Department of Health and Human Resources conveniently forgot to include his time with a consulting firm. That consulting firm had a $10 million contract with the state to reduce government waste, and the contract wasn't bid because it was an emergency contract. Further, the candidate, Steve Corsi, had a history of liking social media posts that cast doubt on COVID-19 treatments, called homosexuality a sin, and said transgender individuals were mentally ill. Those weren't enough, however, for some committee members to disqualify him. One said he voted yes to give the governor his person. Isn't that how this works? You don't pick the best person for the job. You choose the most loyal. And that is all from an editorial opinion piece from the Journal Editorial Board. There are three letters to the editor today, so we'll go to those next. The first one is written by John Stetson from Sioux City, and John writes, "November 5th, 2024, we will go to the voting locations to cast our votes for president. One candidate will have around 91 felony charges in 4 different venues pending trial. One party has repeatedly stated where there is smoke, there is fire. If that is the case, why would anyone ever consider voting for that person? Or if the candidate wants to do away with democracy and readily admits he wants to be a dictator for a day? I believe if a candidate for even one day is a dictator, he will never give it up. Once a dictator, always a dictator. I am sure you want great role models for your children. Is this the guy you want? So I say to all Americans, you know what you have now. Do you really, really want to take a chance on a dictator? If you do, I can only say be careful what you wish for. You may be party to the end of it all. Is a risk really worth everything? And again, this was a letter written by John Stetson of Sioux City. The next letter is written by Jeannie Theobald of Mapleton. And Jeannie writes, a headline in Tuesday's journal, Trump lawyers settle fake elector case regarding plans by Trump's attorneys and campaign officials in Wisconsin for fake electors to file paperwork. They continued the scheme in 6 other states. And then, in a separate article, a lengthy quote from our governor regarding the Colorado Supreme Court decision, in which she stated, frivolous attempts like this to harm the integrity of our elections should be struck down in similar fashion. Iowa Republican Party Chair Jeff Kaufman said, what we all saw as a brazen, unconstitutional power grab attempting to cause election interference. Republicans speaking about election integrity and interference. My laugh for the day. And again, this letter was written by Jeannie Theobald of Mapleton. And our last letter is written by Roger L. Wilson from Mobile. And Roger writes, those opposed to the decision of the Alabama Supreme Court to say a fertilized human egg is considered a human being use the phrase, an egg is not a chicken. However, a fertilized egg in 21 days will develop into a baby chicken. The fertilized human egg in 9 months will also develop into a complete human being. Are those opposed going to work to repeal the federal law that can cost one $5,000 or a year in jail for destroying or disturbing a bald eagle egg, or a $100,000 fine or a year in jail for destroying the egg of the sea turtles? And again, this one was written by Roger L. Wilson of Mobile. And now we move to the piece written by one of the journal regulars, and this week it is Steve Warnstedt. Steve Warnstedt is a Sioux City resident and is Government Affairs Coordinator for Western Iowa Tech Community College and a former Democratic State Senator. He and his wife Mary are the parents of one son and one daughter. And Steve writes, as we move deeper into the income tax filing season, we may hear more discussion about taxes. It is important to remember that these aren't the only taxes we pay. For most people, they aren't even the largest. The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy notes that income taxes have the largest impact on the top 20% of taxpayers. Those earning less than $136,000 pay a higher rate in sales taxes than income taxes. This is true for property taxes as well. The lowest 20% of income earners, up to $26,000 in income, pay 5.95% of their income in property taxes. The next lowest 20% pay 3.8%, and the top 1% pay 1.8%. We hear discussions about the burden of income taxes, especially for high earners. Those taxes take a smaller percentage of their income than property taxes impose on the lowest 40%. Taxes are a burden, but they weigh more heavily on working and middle-class Iowans. This skew against lower-income individuals was also confirmed in a recent WalletHub analysis. While Iowa has the 10th overall highest tax burden, lower- and middle-income earners faced a greater government-imposed strain. Those earning $25,000 paid nearly twice as much of their income to sales and excise tax than those earning $150,000. Those making $50,000 had a sales tax burden 50% higher than the top income group. Only 2 states had a higher property tax burden on lower earning individuals. The shortage of workers is often cited as the major factor limiting Iowa's economic progress. Perhaps policies that lighten the burden on the people performing those jobs could attract more workers. There is a reason working families feel overtaxed. It's because they are. These reports about the struggles faced by working families were released at roughly the same time as the passing of former State Representative Wes Whited of Sioux City. He was always focused on ensuring that ordinary people would get a fair shot. He sensed the reality of the reports above. He also sought to find ways to make the system work for common people. He rallied neighbors to build a ball complex in the Riverside neighborhood. He helped create an organization to advocate for people with developmental disabilities. He established and successfully ran a tract equipment repair business. Bottom line, Wes made things happen. What he lacked in formal education, he more than compensated for in common sense, practical knowledge, and a genuine compassion for those often forgotten. He wasn't a speech maker, but when he spoke, it was genuine, heartfelt, and succinct. His was a life of rolling up his sleeves to make things happen rather than talk about it. A working man for working families was not just a slogan, but a political philosophy for Wes. Many people who didn't know Wes are better off because of him. Wes served in the Iowa House of Representatives from 1997 to 2001 and from 2003 to 2011. He was the vice chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee and longtime member of the Environmental Protection and Local Government Committees. He also served on the Prevention of Disabilities Policy Council. A veteran of the Korean War, Wes loved our country and did everything possible to make life better for all Americans. Finding it difficult to run a business or serve in the legislature, Wes prioritized people and sold his business to lift others up. He later worked at the Orpheum Theater, accompanied by his wife Donna. He was a great legislative partner and a truly good person. We would all be better off with more people like him. And again, this article was written by Steve Warnstead, who is one of the journal's regulars. And now we move to a story about a fire in Lamars. A Saturday morning pallet fire in Lamars caused about $100,000 in damages and required approximately 33 fire and emergency workers to respond. At 4:22 a.m., Lamars Fire Rescue Department was called to a structure fire at Tritz Pallets Camps Company at 1811 Industrial Road in Lamars, according to Lamars Fire and Rescue Chief David Shipper. Once firefighters arrived, they encountered heavy smoke coming from inside the building, and the fire departments of Orange City and Sioux Center were called for aerial ladder trucks and additional support. Lamars firefighters entered the building on the east side through two separate walk-in doors and attacked the fire. They encountered high heat and heavy smoke and flames from the burning pallets inside the building, Shipper said. Ladder trucks were positioned on all sides of the building in case the fire broke through the roof. Several teams rotated in and out of the structure and were able to bring the fire under control. The fire's origin was pinpointed to pallets on a south divider wall in the north end of the building, and the cause was determined to be accidental. The most probable cause for this fire was determined to be a coal ray vac heater that came apart at the ceiling in the building and fell into pallets below. The heater eventually started and ignited the pallets. The fire spread through several pallets and also got into a divider wall and ceiling area. Shipper estimated damage to be $100,000 and said the building is still usable but will require repairs and cleanup. The Lamars Police Department, the Plymouth County Sheriff's Office, Mid-American Energy, and the Lamars Water Department all assisted on the call. And now our next story is about the Hinton wrestling coach resigning. Hinton High School wrestling coach Casey Crawford has submitted his letter of resignation to the Hinton Community School District Board, which will meet on Monday, March 18th, to decide whether or not to accept the resignation. Crawford, who has coached the Blackhawks wrestling team for 15 years, has been on coaching leave since mid-February when allegations emerged that some upperclassmen on the boys' wrestling team may have restrained and shocked younger teammates with a stun gun. Two Hinton students were reassigned, and law enforcement authorities in Coralville, Iowa, and Hinton have been investigating. Hinton Superintendent Ken Slater told the Journal in February that Crawford was on leave from his coaching duties but was still teaching math classes at the school. Crawford said in his letter to the Hinton School Board, "I have thoroughly enjoyed my last 15 years as a wrestling coach at Hinton High School. I'm grateful for those years and that chance to build a program as well as have a positive impact on the athletes' lives. I look forward to continuing my career as a teacher here in Hinton." At least one of the incidents is alleged to have occurred while the team was at the state wrestling dual tournaments February 3rd in Coralville. Coralville Police Chief Shane Crone said an unidentified caller reported a possible assault on February 4th involving juveniles that occurred sometime from February 2nd to February 4th in an unspecified location. The report did not include details about the alleged incident. "It's just listed as an assault," Crone told the Journal in February. He also said at the time that he could not comment further because the case remains under investigation and that he would not release the juveniles' names. In an email, Hinton Police Chief James Conway told the Journal he could not comment because of an ongoing investigation involving multiple agencies. Because of the timing of his leave, Crawford was not with the wrestling team during the state individual tournament in Des Moines. At that event, the team's wrestlers were seen at Wells Fargo Arena wearing t-shirts with the words "Free Crawford." 8 of the Hinton team's wrestlers qualified for the state tournament and were led by assistant coach Woody Skudodas, who was placed on paid administrative leave with Crawford but then was reinstated. 2 mothers of Hinton students told the Journal some parents were not satisfied with the explanation of the disciplinary action taken against 2 of the 3 boys involved in the alleged assaults and questioned how a third was able to return to school. The Hinton School Board's policy manual breaks down a number of student disciplinary measures but does not have a mention of reassigning. However, the manual is not all-encompassing. Slater told the Journal he could not expound on the disciplinary action taken by the school board, but it was doing its best to follow the procedures. The parents also questioned why Crawford was allowed to continue teaching at the school and potentially have contact with the alleged victims. "I feel like it's been hush-hush as much as they can from the get-go," one of the mothers said. "If the public knew the details of these things, I don't know if people of Hinton would support these people on the school board." Both women who spoke to the Journal requested anonymity to protect the identity of their children. Both women said they had seen a video they say shows 2 boys holding another boy down and placing a hand over his mouth while the third boy shocks him with a stun gun as they taunt him. "It is the most gut-wrenching thing. You can see this poor kid's eyes. He was terrified," one of the mothers said. "As many as 7 students were assaulted," she said, "in Coralville or in previous incidents that may have occurred at another tournament." The other mother said, to her knowledge, none of the boys required medical attention. Slater said Tuesday night, following a special meeting to accept the resignations of 2 Hinton principals, that the paid administration leave of Crawford would remain in effect until it's not. The Hinton School Board meeting will be held at 7 p.m. Monday, March 18th. The recommendation to accept Crawford's resignation is one of several action items on the agenda. And our next story is about Dort Senior selected for the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival Fellowship. With less than half of her final semester left, Dort University Senior Miranda Munson has been doing plenty of traveling. This year, she and her fellow Dort University Concert Choir members spent their spring break performing concerts in Montana, Washington, Idaho, and South Dakota, as well as in British Columbia, Canada. Next month promises to be even more eventful. She was one of approximately 125 students from across the country chosen for a fellowship at the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival, or KCACTF, taking place the week of April 21st in Washington, D.C. This event will allow Munson, a theater arts and design major, to participate in master classes while meeting with peers and, most important, theatrical professionals. Munson earned this privilege after picking up a merit award during a regional finals of KCACTF held in January. The Lakeville, Minnesota native explained, "We were encouraged to select something we were passionate about. I was passionate about being the stage manager for Dort's main stage production of The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, and that's what I was chosen for. I was absolutely stunned when they announced my name. I accepted the award and called my parents right away. I remember saying, 'Hi, I just won a national fellowship.' That felt pretty special." After all, Munson comes from a family with a strong interest in the performing arts. Her parents first met when they were both cast in a production of Hello, Dolly. Her twin sister, Isabel, is currently an organ performance major at Dort. Munson's first experience on stage was as an Irish dancer at age 5. Throughout her childhood, she participated in both shows and in choirs. She said, "Even when I was young, I was fascinated by the stuff what was going on backstage. I was always wondering how did things work or why are they doing things that way?" In other words, Munson was already thinking like a stage manager. "The role of a stage manager is very important," she explained. "You're the go-between when it comes to the actors and the director," which was Munson's role in Dort's stage adaptation of C.S. Lewis's classic book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. "As a senior, I was working with a cast that was made up of mainly freshmen who were working on their first college production," which she remembered. "Even my assistant stage director was a freshman." Throughout the rehearsals, Munson carried a legal pad filled with notes. "My assistant questioned me about my pad, which I considered to be a must-have for any stage manager," she said. "By opening night, my assistant also had a legal pad that was crammed with notes." Throughout her years at Dort, Munson has had internships which allowed her to work in children's theater and to take part in a Gilbert and Sullivan summer theater. All of these experiences were given her to understand the importance of stage management. While contemplating graduate school choices, Munson said she'd love to be a stage manager at a Broadway show, yet she would not mind working in regional theater. Munson said there are so many options to choose from. Perhaps she'll find more inspiration during her fellowship at the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival. "It is such a privilege for me," she said. "I can't wait." And now we have some business news. Sioux City Credit Union merges. The membership of the Municipal Federal Credit Union of Sioux City has voted to merge with the Des Moines Premier Credit Union. Municipal Federal's branch at 103 South Fairmont Street will become a branch of Premier Credit Union in early May, according to a press release from Premier. Most members of Municipal Federal will not likely see their account numbers change, according to an FAQ page on the credit union's website, though it is possible that 5% of members will need a new account number due to duplication within the combined organization. The Municipal Federal Credit Union's routing number will transfer to Premier Credit Union, and as such, there shouldn't be a disruption to direct deposits, IPERS benefits, and the like. Premier will honor current loan and savings rates, according to the FAQ page. Automated bill pay will not transfer over and will have to be set up anew. All Municipal Federal members will receive a new debit card. The Municipal Federal Credit Union, originally the Municipal Credit Union, dates back to the Great Depression. It was granted a certificate of organization on February 21, 1938. Originally, the membership consisted of City of Sioux City employees and Woodbury County employees and their families. On September 1, 2022, the credit union became the Municipal Federal Credit Union, which opened membership to Plymouth County, Dakota, and Dixon County in Nebraska, and Union County in South Dakota. The Premier Credit Union was founded in 1933 as the Bankers Life Employees Credit Union. In 1986, Bankers Life Company changed its name to Principal Financial Group, and the credit union changed its name to Principal Financial Group Employees Credit Union. The name changed again in 2001 to Premier Credit Union. And then on the next one is College Radio Foundation gives $1,500 to KWSC-FM. Wayne State College's student-run radio station KWSC 91.9 has received a $1,500 grant award for equipment and system updates, the college announced this week. KWSC-FM is one of the oldest campus radio stations in Nebraska, serving the Wayne community since 1971. The College Radio Grant Program provides financial grants to college radio stations in need of financial assistance. "I am honored and humbled to have received this College Radio Foundation grant award to do much-needed upgrades to KWSC-FM," said Dr. Shane Ahern, Associate Professor of Communication Arts at Wayne State. We are working on replacing our decades-old analog audio boards with industry-standard digital boards. This grant will help ensure that Wayne State College students get the best learning experience in Nebraska. Bishop named Iowa Small Business Person of the Year. Iowa Small Business Person of the Year is Kathy Bishop, president of Aggies, Inc., a barbecue catering company in Sergeant Bluff. The announcement was made Thursday by the Small Business Administration, which administers the award in each state. Honorees will be received at the National Small Business Week Award Ceremony April 28th to 29th at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Washington, D.C. Aggies was started by Bishop, a 1983 graduate of Texas A&M, thus the Aggies, who returned to Sergeant Bluff in 1994 following a decade as a bank examiner in Colorado. The venture was initially a restaurant offering some catering, but in 2009, Bishop pivoted, turning to catering full-time and remaking the restaurant into a venue. Aggies began offering COVID carryout during the pandemic, where customers could place pickup orders from a daily menu posted on Facebook. This concept, along with two PPP loans and a restaurant revitalization fund awarded from SBA, helped Aggie survive the pandemic without laying off any employees. Aggie has since grown and currently employs over 50 full-time and part-time employees. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, March 10th. I'm Dagna, your reader. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.